All right, folks, welcome to Eurofolk Radio, and this is Bloodlines, March 3rd, 2019. And if the beginning of 2019 is an indication, wow, you ain't seen nothing yet, folks. This is going to be a crazy year. If there isn't fighting in the streets this summer, I don't want to be a prophet, try to be a prophet. But man, it doesn't look good, folks, because the Jews and all of their crimes are being exposed on the net by all kinds of independent reporters. And this is really good news. And by the way, that provides us with all kinds of interesting stories that we can present to you. So thanks for being here. Good morning, Pastor Steve, for Bloodlines.
Good morning. I just put the Josephus Antiquities, Book 15, Chapter 9, Paragraph 6 is where we're going to be starting today.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Yeah. So before we start, I have a couple of announcements. We did a show recently. I quoted from the latest issue of the Barnes Review on the origin of the Hungarians. So this is the January-February 2019 issue. I highly suggest, recommend you get a copy of this issue, because it tells about the Hungarians originating in, the Fertile Crescent in India. So as part of the Indo-Aryan wave. So they're not Mongols, or they're not Orientals. They're actually part of, in my opinion, the Yavan. Okay, so they're our people. They're white. So we did a show about this last Friday. But in this issue, they have an article entitled In Defense of the Khazar Theory. And the heading is this: The Khazarian origin of the Ashkenazi Jews has been contested by many, even the late great Revelo Oliver, and today by popular Euro-American rights activist David Duke and others. The prolific author Tex Mars, on the other hand, insists the Khazar theory is accurate and stands by his own research. Who would want to be descended from such a bloodthirsty nation of barbarians? Well, modern Jews would. However, TBR author Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson has adduced stunning evidence from Russian language sources that the Khazar theory is absolutely true. Okay, folks, what have we been telling you?
Valid information.
That's right. But the Jews have been trying to hide this information because it blows their origin as Israel right out of the water. Because 95% of them are actually Ashkenazis. Okay, folks?
Well, that's the largest group of their people, is the Ashkenaz.
Right. Oh, for sure.
The Sephards were mainly the Spanish. And yeah, they have less or different bloodlines than the Ashkenaz.
Right.
The Ashkenaz are straight up, they are the worst of the worst.
Yeah. But actually, the Ashkenaz was a son of Japheth. And it is the mixture of Hittite, that is Jewish blood, and Mongol blood into the Ashkenaz, which creates the Khazar. Okay?
The Khazars were the people that were throwing little babies into the wolf pits, and betting on how long it would take to dismember the babies.
Mm-hmm.
They were so cruel that the Tsar said, you will adopt some form of religion, or we are going to send the Cossacks in and wipe you off the face of the earth.
Right.
So they adopted Talmudic Judaism.
Absolutely. That's what happened. That's what the 13th tribe explains in great detail as well. Okay. And the Jewish author of that book, his name escapes me at the moment.
So you wonder where the baby sacrifice comes from?
Oh, right? Yeah, you wonder.
Okay.
Speaking of baby sacrifice and child sacrifice, there's all kinds of videos now out on YouTube and BitChute and elsewhere coming from the NYPD about the contents of Anthony Weiner's laptop. They have recovered 650,000 emails. Okay, all the stuff that Hillary tried to destroy from her server is on Anthony Weiner. Well, because Anthony Weiner is the husband of Uma Abedin, Hillary Clinton's lover for the last 20 years. Okay.
A fag marrying a fag to cover up the fact that they're fags.
Right? There you go.
And boy, what a twisted web.
Okay. And the sources tell us, and you can just look on YouTube and dial in NYPD Weiner laptop. Okay. So the story is that Comey wanted to, just dropped the whole matter of Hillary's emails altogether. But apparently the NYPD contacted him and told him some of the contents of, the laptop concerning Hillary Clinton. And they told him, you better reopen this investigation about Hillary's emails. And that's when he went back and started talking about it again, because he wanted to drop the whole matter. So these sources say that the NYPD forced him to do this, okay? All right. The story is that there is a video of Hillary Clinton and Huma Abedin sacrificing a white girl and drinking her blood. Now, do you know why Hillary Clinton is terrified? And so they got to dot all the I's, cross all the T's before they go public with this. And the story is they're getting ready to go public with this, but they're getting blowback from the Justice Department and the FBI to keep this under wraps. You can imagine. You can imagine what pressure the NYPD is under to keep this under wraps. So, and then, so they're getting threatened by the feds. So, and apparently they're also saying that Donald Trump has seen the video. So, and he saw it way back in 2016. That's why he said, "You're going to jail, Hillary," right? So this could be the biggest story to ever hit news ever. Of political corruption. So
we will see what we will see. We will see. They talk a good game all the time.
Right, right.
But I'm not going to hold my breath.
No. I'm just reporting what's going on, and we won't bother posting it on EFR until they actually go public with this. Okay. So it's nice to have a scoop and produce a headline before anybody else does, but this is too big, it's too important. We don't want to get it wrong, okay? And one more thing, the Juicy Smollett case. Black people doing their own independent media are fingering Lee Daniels, the black homosexual poofter director, who's actually won a couple of Academy Awards as being the mastermind behind the Juicy Smollett self-lynching. Okay? Right? We knew it was going to go deeper than just Juicy. And so we're waiting for, actual outing. And then Kamala Harris, by the way, she was promoting an anti-lynching bill, a federal anti-lynching bill, which was passed by the Senate right after the Jussie Smollett self-lynching. Okay? Do you get the picture, folks? You get the picture?
Well, that's just sort of a stupid law, because lynching has always been illegal. I mean, what?
Right.
Duh.
Right. Yeah. But she gets brownie points, don't you see?
She's got running. A law in Kentucky that you're not allowed to make a noose with 13 turns of the rope.
Really?
You could. It's illegal. That's a law here.
If why 13?
12 turns, because that's the official, the rope that they used to use to hang criminals.
Mm-hmm.
And 13 turns of that big hemp, and that was not little rope. That's not little.
Oh,
rope.
Yeah, that was strong. That was strong rope.
It was great, big, as big as your thumb.
Yeah.
So when that rope straightened out at the end of the drop, it would snap that neck just boom.
Right.
Over.
Mm-hmm.
Because the botching a hanging, if the guy doesn't die, he has to hang there until he's dead.
Until he dies. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah,
that reminds.
And that is a messy.
Yeah.
If that happens, they soil themselves heavily.
Oh, sure. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you're being racked with pain for hours. Yeah. Okay. So those are the latest developments in those two stories, and we're just waiting for the confirmation of what we just reported. And we're almost never wrong, folks. Almost never wrong. Okay, I forgot where you said we were at, Pastor Steve. Book 15.
Book 15, chapter 9, paragraph 6.
Paragraph
I have
six.
It here
go ahead.
Marked in red, and I'm ready to roll until you catch up with me.
Yeah, go ahead. I'll catch up.
All right. Now, pardon me. Let me mute my mic. I have to blow my nose. I'm
okay.
Sorry, just a second.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, and the background of this is that Herod had been building all kinds of extravagant pagan temples and buildings, like a copy of the Roman festival, where they have the chariots and the gladiator games and all that kind of stuff. This is the kind of thing that Herod was doing, proving beyond any doubt that he was a pagan.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Here we go. I'm right. Ready.
Go
paragraph
ahead.
6. Now upon his observation of a place near the sea, which was very proper for containing a city and was before called Strato's Tower, he set about getting a plan for a magnificent city there and erected many edifices with great diligence all over it, and this of white stone. Now, let's take a break here. You can imagine white stone buildings, how pretty they would be.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. He also adorned it with most sumptuous palaces and large edifices for containing the people. And what was the greatest and most laborious work of all, he adorned it with a haven that was always free from the waves of the sea. Its size was not less than the Piraeus at Athens, and had toward the city a double station for the ships. In other words, he built a false harbor, but it was protected from the sea.
Right.
Okay, so the ships could harbor there during storms, etc., etc. It was of excellent workmanship, and this was the more remarkable for its being built in a place that of itself was not suitable to such noble structures, but was to be brought to perfection by materials from other places and at very great expenses. In other words, he just picked a bad spot and decided he was going to put all the stuff there.
Yeah.
Because
like New York City.
I'm the tetrarch and I say so.
Yeah, right.
Okay. This city is situated in Phoenicia in the passages by sea to Egypt between Joppa and Dora, which are lesser maritime cities and not fit for havens on account of the impetuous south winds that beat upon them, which rolling the sands that come from the sea against the shores do not admit of ships lying in their station, but the merchants are generally there forced to ride at their anchors in the sea itself. So Herod tried to rectify this inconvenience and laid out such a boundary toward the land as might be sufficient for a harbor wherein the great ships might lie in safety. And this he effected by letting down vast stones of above 50 feet in length.
Wow.
Not less than 18 in breadth and 9 in depth into 20 fathom deep. And as some were lesser, so were others bigger than those dimensions. In other words, he built a seawall.
Mm-hmm.
This seawall, which he built by the seaside, was 200 feet wide, the half of which was opposed to the current of the waves, so as to keep off those waves which were to break upon them, and so was called Proximatia, or the first breaker of the waves. But the other half had upon it a wall with several towers, the largest of which was named Drusus, and was a work of very great excellence, and had its name from Drusus, the son-in-law of Caesar, who died young. Not talk about sucking up.
Mm-hmm.
There were also a great number of arches where the mariners dwelt. There was also before them a quay, or landing place, which ran around the entire haven and was a most agreeable walk to such as had a mind to that exercise. But the entrance or mouth of the port was made on the north quarter, on which side was the stillest of the winds of all in this place, and the basis of the whole circuit on the left hand, as you entered the port, supported a round turret, which was made very strong in order to resist the greatest waves, while on the right hand, as you entered, stood two vast stones, and those, each of them larger than the turret, which were near to them, these stood upright and were joined together. Now, there were edifices all along the circular haven, made of the finest stone, with a certain elevation whereon was erected a temple that was seen a great way off by those that were sailing for that haven, and had in it two statues, the one of Rome, in other words, Romulus, the other of Caesar. The city itself was called Caesarea, which was also itself built of fine materials,
mm-hmm.
and was of a fine structure. The very subterranean vaults and cellars had no less of architecture bestowed on them than had the buildings above ground. Some of these vaults carried things at even distances to the haven and to the sea, but one of them ran obliquely and bound all the rest together. In other words, the passage just went all around all of them.
Mm-hmm.
That both the rain and the filth of the citizens were together carried off with ease, and the sea itself, upon the flux of the tide from without, came into the city and washed it all clean. In other words, a public toilet sewer system.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What? Well, hey, that was
the Romans
smart.
Were great at that stuff. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, Herod also built therein a theater of stone, and on the south quarter behind the port, an amphitheater also capable of holding a vast number of men and conveniently situated for a prospect to the sea. So this city was thus finished in 12 years.
Big project.
During which time, the king did not fail to go on both with the work and to pay the charges that were necessary.
Well, he had to be robbing the treasury of Judah. That's the only way he could pay for this stuff. So, but typical Jew, taking our money and using it to, how should I put it, glorify itself. Right? That's what the Jews do.
Now, think of this. He's paying all these people to do all this work and putting all this money in this public work.
Mm-hmm.
That would make him very popular, wouldn't it?
Sure.
With all that money.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that ends chapter 9. Now we start chapter 10. I guess you want to take a section?
Right. Yeah. I just want to say that being popular is the essence of a democracy. Okay.
Oh, absolutely.
It's because the founding fathers had it absolutely right, and the reason for let's call it that they had an idea of aristocracy of knowledge or intelligence, so that in a republic, only the more intelligent and faithful people would get elected, but in a democracy, the candidates are elected by the mob.
Popularity.
Popularity. Okay. And in the Dead Sea Scrolls. In the protocols, they say over and over again, we want democracy. We want democracy because the people are so easily fooled and they vote for a popular candidate, not the better candidate. Okay.
And well, then, what have we got for a long time in this country?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Popular candidate.
And they control
those
the popular mood.
Talking right. heads that say a lot of good stuff before the election and then all do the same thing after the election.
So, and people forget what the promises were, and they go back to living their private lives, you know, with nose to the grindstone if they're workers, and, petty life if you're a welfare recipient, you know, a life of drugs and crime. So these people are quite easily manipulated by the press and by, you know, the kosher political system. And, you know, as long as there's democracy, and I believe in meritocracy, and when the country was first founded, the only people who could vote were those who had white people, only white people could vote, and those who had property, such as a farmer, or a business. Yep. And if you didn't qualify in those two categories, you could not vote. Mm-hmm. And that's what we need to go back to. And, okay, so chapter 10, the descriptive heading states how Herod sent his sons to Rome, how also he was accused by Zenodorus and the Gadarenes, but was but was cleared of what they accused him of course, because the Romans were, you know, clearing him all the time, and withal gained to himself the goodwill of Caesar. Concerning the Pharisees, the Essenes, and Menahem. Okay.
All right. Do you remember who the Gadarenes were?
No.
All right. When the demon-possessed came out of the tombs, that was the land of the Gadarenes, and he... removed that demon. Yeshua removed that demon from him.
Uh-huh.
Remember that?
Right. Okay.
Gathering.
Yeah, we discussed
that
one
ties
of those.
In, that ties in with the New Testament.
Okay. Very good. Very good. All right. So, now this is a historical account by Josephus, who was a Judahite. And this is Antiquities of Judah, not Antiquities of the Jews, because the Jews are not Judah. Paragraph 1. When Herod was engaged in such matters, and when he had already re-edified Sebaste in Samaria, he resolved to send his sons Alexander and Aristobulus to Rome to enjoy the company of Caesar, who, when they came thither, lodged at the house of Pollio. All right, there's an asterisk here. This Pollio, with whom Herod's sons lived at Rome, was not the Pollio the Pharisee, already mentioned by Josephus, but Asinius Pollio the Roman. Okay, so we have a Pharisee by the name of Pollio also. Continuing. Lodged at the house of Pollio, who was very fond of Herod's friendship, and they had leave to lodge in Caesar's own palace. Okay, so the Jews always have the ear of the king, right? And they had, for he received these sons of Herod with all humanity, they're a mensch, and gave Herod leave to give his kingdom to which of his sons he pleased. And besides all this, he bestowed on him Trachon and Batania and Oronitis, which he gave him on the occasion following. I guess these are towns. One Zenodorus had hired what was called the house of Lysanias, who, as he was not satisfied with his revenues, became a partner with the robbers that inhabited the Trachonites, or Trachonites, and so procured him a larger income. For the inhabitants of those places lived a mad way. Oh, liberals! And pillaged the country from the Damascenes, while Zenodorus did not restrain them, but partook of the prey they acquired. So the madder the people live, the more money they spend and the more taxes you collect, right? Isn't that how it works? Yeah. There is a footnote here. The character of this Zenodorus is so like that of the famous robber of the same name in Strabo, and that about this very country, and about this very time also, that there is little doubt that they were the same. Continuing. Now, as the neighboring people were hereby great sufferers, they complained to Varro, who was the president of Syria, and entreated him to write to Caesar about this injustice of Zenodorus. When these matters were laid before Caesar, he wrote back to Varro to destroy those nests of robbers and give the land to Herod. Mm-hmm. Man, Herod is just being bestowed with all kinds of stuff by the Romans. That by his care the neighboring countries might be no longer disturbed with these doings of the Trachonites, for it was not an easy thing to restrain them, since this way of robbery had been their usual practice. Okay, so they're an established group of robbers, and they had no other way to get their living because they had neither any city of their own, oh, Vikings, right, nor lands in their possession, but only some receptacles and dens in the earth. And there they and their cattle lived in common together. However, they had made contrivances to get pools of water and laid up corn and granaries for themselves, and were able to make great resistance by issuing out on the sudden against any that attacked them. For the entrance of their caves were narrow, in which but one could come in at a time, and the places within incredibly large and made very wide. But the ground over their habitations was not very high, but rather on a plain, while the rocks are altogether hard and difficult to enter upon, unless anyone gets into the plain road by the guidance of another, for these roads are not straight, but have several revolutions. But when these men are hindered from their wicked preying upon their neighbors, Their custom is to prey upon one another, insomuch that no sort of injustice comes amiss to them. Okay, so they were madmen, as he described earlier. Wild marauders. But when Herod had received this grant from Caesar and was come into this country, he procured skillful guides and put a stop to their wicked robberies and procured peace and quietness to the neighboring people and thus built up his reputation. Over to you. Yeah.
There we go. This is paragraph 2, chapter 10. But Zenodorus was grieved in the first place because his principality was taken away from him, and still more so because he envied Herod, who had gotten it. So he went up to Rome to accuse him, but returned back again without success. Now Agrippa was, about this time, sent to succeed Caesar in the government of the countries beyond the Ionian Sea, upon whom Herod lighted when he was wintering about Mytilene, for he had been his particular friend and companion, and then returned into Judea again. However, some of the Gadarenes came to Agrippa and accused Herod, whom he sent back bound to the king without giving them the hearing.
Oh, boy, nice.
Well, don't badmouth my friend.
Yeah,
lock him up.
Yeah, I'll rock you.
But still, the Arabians, who of old bore ill will to Herod's government, were irritated and at that time attempted to raise a rebellion in his dominions, and, as they thought, upon a more justifiable occasion. For Zenodorus, despairing already of success as to his own affairs, prevented his enemies by selling to those Arabians a part of his principality called Auranitis, for the value of 50 talents.
That's not very much.
50 talents of gold.
Oh!
Quite a bit, right.
Yeah, okay. Hmm.
But as this was included in the donations of Caesar, they contested the point with Herod and as unjustly deprived of what they had bought. Sometimes they did this by making incursions upon him, and sometimes by attempting force against him, and sometimes by going to law with him. Moreover, they persuaded the poorer soldiers to help them and were troublesome to him, out of a constant hope that they should reduce the people to raise a rebellion, in which designs those that are in the most miserable circumstances of life are still the most earnest.
That's for sure.
And although Herod had been a great while apprised of these attempts, yet did not he indulge any severity to them, but by rational methods aimed to mitigate things, and is not willing to give any impetus, for disturbances. In other words, he didn't want to fight.
Yeah. So we can see from this report that Herod's rule was constantly plagued by minor insurrections, people coming to him complaining, and rightfully so, because he's the author of all of this turmoil. So, you know, but he the one thing in his favor was that the Romans supported him at every single turn.
That's because all the money he sent to Caesar.
That's right. That's right.
I wonder why. That's how it works today.
That's exactly how it works today. Number 3. Now when Herod had already reigned 17 years, Caesar came into Syria, at which time the greatest part of the inhabitants of Gadara clamored against Herod as one that was heavy in his injunctions and tyrannical. These reproaches they mainly ventured upon by the encouragement of Zenodorus, who took his oath that he would never leave Herod till he had procured that the day should be severed from Herod's kingdom. and joined to Caesar's province. Okay, so a big insurrection here. The Gadarenes were induced hereby and made no small cry against him, the more boldly, because those that had been delivered up by Agrippa were not punished by Herod, who let them go and did them no harm. For indeed he was the principal man in the world who appeared almost inexorable in punishing crimes in his own family. But very generous in remitting the offenses that were committed elsewhere. What do you call this? Selective justice? And while they accused Herod of injuries and plunderings and subversion of temples, he stood unconcerned and was ready to make his defense. However, Caesar gave him his right hand and remitted nothing of his kindness to him upon this disturbance of the multitude. And indeed, these things were alleged the first day, but the hearing proceeded no further. For as the Gadarenes saw the inclination of Caesar and of his assessors, and expected, as they had reason to do, that they should be delivered up to the king, some of them, out of a dread of the torments they might undergo, cut their own throats in the night time, and some of them threw themselves down precipices, and others of them cast themselves into the river. Rocks fall on us, right? Yeshua's prophecy of the end days. Rocks fall on us, and mountains fall on us, and destroy themselves of their own accord. Which accident seemed a sufficient condemnation of the rashness and crimes they had been guilty of. Whereupon Caesar made no longer delay, but cleared Herod from the crimes that he was accused of. Another happy accident there was, which was a further great advantage to Herod at this time, for Zenodorus's belly burst, and a great quantity of blood issued from him in his sickness, and he thereby departed this life at Antioch in Syria. So Caesar, all of this good fortune is happening to Herod. Maybe he was poisoned by Herod, right? Okay. So where was I? So Caesar bestowed this country, which was no small one, upon Herod. It lay between Trichon and Galilee and contained Ulatha and Peneus and the country round about. He also made him one of the procurators of Syria and commanded that they should do everything with his approbation. And in short, he arrived at that pitch of felicity whereas there were but two men that governed the vast Roman Empire, first Caesar and then Agrippa, who was his principal favorite. Caesar preferred no one to Herod besides Agrippa, and Agrippa made no one his greater friend than Herod besides Caesar. So you could see in the area there was a triumvirate of Caesar and these two Edomites. And when he had acquired such freedom, he begged of Caesar a tetrarchy for his brother Pheroras, while he did himself bestow upon him a revenue of 100 talents out of his own kingdom, that in case he came to any harm himself, his brother might be in safety, and that his sons might not have dominion over him. Oh, okay, so Herod's afraid that his sons would take over in his place. So when he had conducted Caesar to the sea and was returned home, he built him a most beautiful temple of the whitest stone in Zendorus's country near the place called Paneum. This is a very fine cave in a mountain under which there is a great cavity in the earth, and the cavern is abrupt and prodigiously deep and full of a still water. Over it hangs a vast mountain, and under the caverns arise the springs of the river Jordan. Very interesting. Herod adorned this place, which was already a very remarkable one, still further by the erection of this temple, which he dedicated to Caesar. Okay, folks, I mean, how can anybody read this history and not realize that Herod was a total apostate? Even if he were a Judahite, he would be one of the worst apostates of Israel. But we know he's an Edomite, And so
and
this
a total suck up.
A total suck up, right. There is a footnote here on tetrarchy. A tetrarchy properly and originally denoted the fourth part of an entire kingdom or country, and a tetrarch one that was ruler of such a fourth part. Okay, as we have mentioned, that Herod was, in fact, a tetrarch, not a king. Over to you.
Buddy. All right, this is section four. At which time Herod released to his subjects the third part of their taxes, under pretense, indeed, of relieving them after the drought they had had. But the main reason was to recover their goodwill. He bribed the people.
Yeah.
Which he now wanted, for they were uneasy at him because of the innovations he had introduced in their practices of the dissolution of their religion and of the disuse of their own customs. In other words, he was getting rid of their
religious
practices.
Yes, right.
And was putting this paganism in. And the people everywhere talked against him, like those that were still more provoked and disturbed at his procedure, against which discontents he greatly guarded himself and took away the opportunities they might have to disturb him and directed them to be always at work. Not did he permit the citizens either to meet together or to walk or eat together, but watched everything they did, just like today.
Yeah, total dictator.
When any were caught, they were severely punished.
Bolshevism.
You can't have a CI meeting.
Bolshevism. You can see the Bolshevism.
You can't meet on the courthouse steps like the Constitution says.
Right? Yeah. By the way, this paragraph where everywhere the people were talking against him, this is happening to Justin Trudeau as we speak in Canada because of all of his scandals. Back to you.
And many there were who were brought to the citadel, Hyrcania, both openly and secretly, and were there put to death. And there were spies set everywhere.
Dum, dum, dum. Right? They knock on the door in the middle of the night.
Both in the city and in the roads, who watched those that met together, the ATF, the FBI, the CIA.
Right, ADL.
ADL. It is reported that he did not himself neglect this part of caution, but that he would oft-times himself take the clothing of a private man and mix among the multitude in the nighttime and judge what opinion they had of his government. Talk
they
about
hate
paranoid.
Me. Yeah, they hate me.
Fake news.
Yeah,
fake
right.
Why does everybody hate you?
Yeah, right.
And as for those that could no way be reduced to acquiescence under his scheme of government, he prosecuted them all manner of ways, but for the rest of the multitude, he required that they should be obliged to take an oath of faithfulness to him, and at the same time compelled them to swear that they would bear him goodwill and continue certainly so to do in his management of the government. And indeed, a great part of them, either to please him or out of fear of him, yielded to what he required of them. Sort of like you'll have to take the mark of the beast.
Right.
But for such as were of a more open and generous disposition and had indignation at the force he used on them, he, by one means or another, made away with them. In other words, he got rid of them.
Right.
He tried also to persuade Pollio the Pharisee and Sameas and the greatest part of their scholars to take the oath, but these would neither submit to do so, nor were they punished together with the rest out of the reverence he bore to Pollio.
Now, Semaeus, hold on. I think Semaeus was actually the guy who prophesied against Herod. Okay?
Yeah.
And I'm surprised that Herod hadn't done away with him before this, but please continue.
The Essenes also, as we call a sect of ours, were excused from this imposition. These men lived the same kind of life as do those whom the Greeks call Pythagoreans, concerning whom I shall discourse more fully elsewhere. However, it is but fit to set down here the reasons why Herod had these Essenes in such honor and thought higher of them than their mortal nature required. Nor will this account be unsuitable to the nature of this history, as it will show the opinion men had of these Essenes.
Okay, very good. So the next paragraph is about
those
the Essenes.
Those are the ones that secreted all those scrolls, etc., etc.,
right,
in those caves by the Dead Sea. They're the ones that put together the Dead Sea Scrolls. Those were the Essenes.
So preserving
the background.
Yeah. Preserving the Old Testament, or much of it. Okay.
Yes.
So they That's were so. Judahites. The Essenes were Judahites.
Oh, yes.
And my guess is the reason Herod did not want to tamper with them was because, well, they were preserving the literature, and they probably knew the law better than the Pharisees, and he might even consult them every once in a while. What is the actual law? But we'll find out.
Well, and the fact that they were so well thought of by the people.
Oh, right. Yeah.
They were in high esteem of the people, and he didn't want to stir things up because he had enough problems as it was with his actions.
Yeah, so like that would be if he messed with the most honored people of the land, you know, there might be a rebellion. Okay,
it would take things over the top for him.
Right.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. So he exercised caution with the Essenes. Paragraph 5. Now there was one of these Essenes, whose name was Menahem, who had this testimony, that he not only conducted his life after an excellent manner, but had the foreknowledge of future events given to him by God also. This man once saw Herod when he was a child, and going to school, and saluted him as king of the Judeans. But he, thinking that either he did not know him, or that he was in jest, put him in mind that he was but a private man. But Menahem smiled to himself and clapped him on his backside with his hand and said, quote, however that be, thou wilt be king, and wilt begin thy reign happily, for God finds thee worthy of it. Okay, so here we see that many of these prophecies are accurate, and we have to question how Josephus is reporting this, because obviously Yahweh doesn't find Herod worthy. However, Yahweh uses people like Herod to punish us.
Yep.
Because
same
of our
way he did King Shaul. King Shaul was a total screw up.
Yeah. So I wouldn't say worthy, but maybe this is what Josephus reports, because he still has to ingratiate himself with the Romans in writing this history, and to some extent even Herod. I don't know how, Herod wasn't alive, but Herod Agrippa was, I think, when this was written. And do thou remember the blows that Menahem hath given thee as being a signal of the change of thy fortune? Okay, so he says, your reign will start out happily, but it's not going to work out that way. And truly, this will be the best reason for thee that thou love justice and piety towards God and clemency towards thy citizens. Yet do I know how thy whole conduct will be, that thou wilt not be such a one, for thou wilt excel all men in happiness and obtain an everlasting reputation, but will forget piety and righteousness, and these crimes will not be concealed from God at the conclusion of thy life, when thou wilt find that he will be mindful of them and punish thee for them, unquote.
You can run, but you can't hide.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now you can imagine Herod's face upon hearing these words. Okay. Now, at that time, Herod did not at all attend, because this was done earlier. Now, at that time, Herod did not at all attend to what Menahem said, as having no hopes of such advancement. Okay, because he wasn't king yet. But a little afterward, or tetrarch, when he was so fortunate as to be advanced to the dignity of a tetrarch, and was in the height of his dominion, he sent for Menahem and asked him how long he should reign. Okay.
All right, that's pronounced Menachem.
Menachem, right, right. And so now Herod remembers the prophecy that Menachem made, okay, and called for him. So how long am I going to live? Right. Menachem did not tell him the full length of his reign. Wherefore, upon that silence of his, he asked him further, whether he should reign 10 years or not. He replied, yes, 20, nay, 30 years, but did not assign the just determinate limit of his reign. Herod was satisfied with these replies, and gave Menahem his hand and dismissed him, and from that time he continued to honor all the Essenes. Okay, so this is the basis for his honoring the Essenes. Mm-hmm. We have thought it proper to relate these facts to our readers, how strange soever they may be, and to declare what hath happened among us, because many of these Essenes have, by their excellent virtue, been thought worthy of this knowledge of divine revelation. So they were esteemed as prophets.
Yep.
Okay, chapter 11. It's all yours.
Okay, let me flip okay. the page here. I've been following so along.
Yeah, the Essenes, and elsewhere he says the Essenes were really the only group of priests who were of Judah. They were pure Judah. The Sadducees and the Pharisees were not, as we have been finding out from Josephus so far.
Right. We got a little over a half an hour here, so we should get pretty yeah. heavily in chapter 11.
Mm-hmm.
All right, this is how Herod rebuilt the temple and raised it higher and made it more magnificent than it was before, as also concerning that tower which he called Antonia. Okay, this is paragraph 1 of chapter 11. And now Herod, in the 18th year of his reign, and after the acts already mentioned, undertook a very great work, that is, to build of himself the temple of God. Now, they have a footnote here. It was the third temple. Okay.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I've got it if you don't. If you can't
find it.
No,
I'm looking at the... Yeah, go ahead. You can okay. read the footnote.
Yeah. The fancy of the modern Jews, which is, I think he's talking about contemporary Jews here, so the word Jew is good, in calling this temple, which was really the third of their temples, the second temple, followed so long by later Christians, seems to be without any solid foundation. Okay, what have we been telling you, folks? They're worshiping not at the Temple of Solomon. They're worshiping at the Temple of Herod. That's Herod's wall, folks. That's you know, right. The Wailing Wall? Kabang, kabang, bang their heads against it. Made Trump bang his head against that Wailing Wall.
They just need to do it a lot harder.
Yeah, that's right. So even Josephus, well, actually William Whiston, created this footnote telling us, yeah, that's all wrong. They're not worshiping at Solomon's temple. They're worshiping at Herod's temple. Back to you.
And that's the Dome of the Rock and all of that stuff that's up right. on the top.
It's all pagan. That, it's all pagan.
That's not that's not where Yahweh's temple was.
Mm-hmm.
That's where everything. You have to remember, everything the Jews do is fake. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And they will tell you this, and they will publicize it so much that the public will believe it. because they own all the media. A great work, that is, to build of himself the temple of God. What God?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And make it larger in boundary and to raise it to a most magnificent altitude, as esteeming it to be the most glorious of all his actions, as it really was, to bring it to perfection, and that this would be sufficient for an everlasting memorial of him.
That's the Wailing Wall. If you've ever seen any pictures of it or movies of it, it's extremely high.
Yep.
This is describing the Wailing Wall, folks, right here.
Right there. But as he knew the multitude were not ready nor willing to assist him in so vast a design, he thought to prepare them first by making a speech to them and then set about the work itself. So he called them together and spoke thus to them. Quote, I think I need not speak to you, my countrymen, about such other works as I have done since I came to the kingdom, although I may say they have been performed in such a manner as to bring more security to you than glory to myself. Horse crap. For I have neither been negligent in the most difficult times about what tended to ease your necessities.
Justin Trudeau.
Nor have the buildings I have made been so proper to preserve me as yourself from injuries. I just want to help you.
I did it all for you.
Yes. And I imagine that with God's assistance, I have advanced the nation of the Judeans to a degree of happiness which they never had before. Oh, please. And for the particular edifices belonging to your own country and to your own cities, and also to those cities that we have lately acquired, in other words,
yeah,
gifts, which we have erected and greatly adorned and thereby augmented the dignity of your nation. Boy, he's landing on thick.
Oh, man, yeah.
It seems to me a needless task to enumerate them to you, since you well know them yourselves.
Yeah, you know how glorious I am.
But as to that undertaking which I have a mind to set about at present, and which will be a work of the greatest piety,
Hoover Dam,
and excellence that can possibly be undertaken by us, I will now declare it to you. By us. Now, he's including them in this. Like,
well, now, it's interesting. It's interesting that in this speech, he refers to the people as you and yours, your own country, your own cities. Instead of, he doesn't use the word our. He's not being inclusive here, which is very interesting. But, you know, it definitely was not an Israelite or a Judahite. So this would be the proper language. He was a usurper. These would be the proper pronouns for him to use. Back to you.
That's correct. Our fathers, indeed, when they returned from Babylon, his fathers would never return from Babylon. He was an Edomite.
That's right. Now he switches to our. Suddenly he switches to our, right? Yeah. Instead of your.
Built this temple to God Almighty, yet does it want 60 cubits of its height. For so much did that first temple which Solomon built exceed this temple. And that's why he built the Wailing Wall.
That's right.
Nor let anyone condemn our fathers for their negligence or want of piety herein. For it was not their fault that the temple was no higher. For they were Cyrus and Darius, the son of Histopes, who determined the measures for its rebuilding. And it has been by reason of the subjection of the fathers of ours to them, ours now,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And to their posterity, and after them to the Macedonians that they had not the opportunity to follow the original model of this pious edifice, nor could raise it to its ancient altitude. But since I am now, by God's will, your governor, and I have had peace a long time and have gained great riches and large revenues, and what is the principal feeling of all? I am at amity with and well regarded by the Romans, who,
no doubt,
if I may so say, are the rulers of the whole world.
We have no king but Caesar.
I will try to correct that imperfection which has arisen from the necessity of our affairs and the slavery we have been under formerly, and to make a thankful return after the most pious manner to God for what blessings I have received from him by giving me this kingdom, and that by rendering his temple as complete as I am able. Oh, what a crock.
Spoken like a Talmudic Pharisee. Wow. Wow. The arrogance. The absolute, I mean, don't the Jews display this arrogance even today?
Chutzpah.
Yeah, chutzpah. Chutzpah. You gotta spit when you chutzpah.
Chutzpah, yeah.
Yeah, right?
Right? You gotta all have right. One of those spit tunes with
yeah,
this, you know.
Right? Yep.
Ding.
Yeah. Hey, yeah, you can get a bell ringer there. All right.
Yeah.
You got it, bro. You got it. All right, section two. And this was the speech which Herod made to them. But still this speech affrighted many of the people as being unexpected by them, and because it seemed incredible. It did not, you know, because they knew he was a usurper. And here he is, oh, I'm so glorious, and God has put me before you. It seemed incredible. It did not encourage them, for they were afraid that he would pull down the whole edifice and not be able to bring his intentions to perfection for its rebuilding. And this danger appeared to them to be very great, and the vastness of the undertaking to be such as could hardly be accomplished. But while they were in this disposition, the king encouraged them, and told them he would not pull down their temple till all things were gotten ready for building it up again. And as he promised them this beforehand, so he did not break his word with them, but got ready, probably the only promise he ever kept, but got ready 1,000 wagons that were to bring stones for the building, and chose out 10,000 of the most skillful workmen, and bought 1,000 sacerdotal garments for the priests, and had some of them taught the arts of the stone cutters, and others of carpenters, and then began to build. But this not till everything was well prepared for the work. Oh, they rebuilt the Twin Towers. The plans for rebuilding the Twin Towers were already laid in the 1990s by Larry Silverstein. Over to you.
Yeah, but they're going to build them on a different site because now it's a National Heritage Site or whatever.
Yeah.
Boy. And this is section 3, paragraph 3. So Herod took away the old foundations and laid others and erected the temple upon them, being in length 100 cubits and in height 20 additional cubits, of which, upon the sinking of their foundations, fell down. And this part of it was that we resolved to raise again in the days of Nero.
Wow. So I wonder how many workers were killed when this wall collapsed.
They don't count. He didn't mention that.
Mm-hmm.
Now the temple was built of stones that were white and strong, and each of their length was 25 cubits, their height was 8, and their breadth about 12. And the whole structure, as also the structure of the royal cloister, was on each side much lower, but the middle was much higher until they were visible to those that dwelt in the country for a great many furlongs.
High rise.
Mm-hmm. But chiefly to such as lived near them and those that approached to them. Okay? Big ostentatious building.
Oh, yep.
The temple had doors also at the entrance and lintels over them of the same height with the temple itself. They were adorned with embroidered veils, with their flowers of purple and pillars interwoven. And over these, but under the crown work, was spread out a golden vine, which its branch, with its branches hanging down from a great height. The size and fine workmanship of which was a surprising sight to the spectators, to see what vast materials there were and with what great skill the workmanship was done. He also encompassed the entire temple with very large cloisters, contriving them to be in a due proportion thereto. And he laid out larger sums of money upon them than had been done before him, until it seemed that no one else had so greatly adorned the temple as he had done.
Even more magnificent than Solomon.
There was a large wall to both the cloisters, which wall was itself the most prodigious work that was ever heard of by man. Mm-hmm. The hill was a rocky ascent that declined by degrees toward the east part of the city until it came to an elevated level. This hill it was which Solomon, who was the first of our kings by divine revelation, encompassed with a wall. It was of excellent workmanship upward and round the top of it. He also built a wall below, beginning at the bottom, which was encompassed by a deep valley. And at the south side, he laid rocks together and bound them one to another with lead and included some of the inner parts until it proceeded to a great height and until both the size of the square edifice and its altitude were immense, and until the vastness of the stones in front were plainly visible on the outside, yet so that the inward parts were fastened together with iron and preserved the joints immovable for all future times.
Yeah, otherwise the pressure, right. The outward pressure, it would collapse. Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
When this work for the foundation was done in this manner and joined together as a part of the hill itself, down at the bedrock, okay?
Right.
To the very top of it, he wrought it all into one outward surface and filled up the hollow places which were about the wall and made it a level on the external upper surface and a smooth level also. This hill was walled all around and encompassed 4 furlongs, the distance of each angle containing in length 1 furlong. But within this wall, and on the very top of all, there ran another wall of stone also, having on the east quarter a double cloister of the same length with the wall, in the midst of which was the temple itself. This cloister looked to the gates of the temple, and it had been adorned by many kings in former times, and around the entire temple were fixed the spoils taken from barbarous nations. All these had been dedicated to the temple by Herod, with the addition of those he had taken from the Arabians. That ends section 3.
Yeah, Herod deserves an Academy Award. Section 4. Now on the north side of the temple was built a citadel, whose walls were square and strong and of extraordinary firmness. This citadel was built by the kings of the Asmonean race. The Asmonean race are Judah. There was a Maccabees, who were also high priests before Herod, and they called it the tower in which were reposited the vestments of the high priest, which the high priest only put on at the time when he was to offer sacrifice. So you see, these priests still existed, but they didn't have the power they used to under Herod. These vestments King Herod kept in that place, and after his death they were under the power of the Romans until the time of Tiberius Caesar, under whose reign Vitellius, the president of Syria, when he once came to Jerusalem and had been most magnificently received by the multitude, he had a mind to make some requital of the kindness they had shown him. So upon their petition to have those holy vestments in their power, he wrote about them to Tiberius Caesar, who granted his request. And this, their power over the sacerdotal vestments, continued with the Judahites till the death of King Agrippa. And in a similar manner, Pastor Steve, the royal priesthood that did the sacrifices and kept the temple proper, they were still of Judah. And Elizabeth's father was one of these temple priests. He was the one, the whole priesthood that was dedicated to keeping the temple, the courses. The 24 courses of priests, those were still Judahites. And Elizabeth's husband was one of these men. Continuing. But after that, Cassius Longinus, who was president of Syria, and Cuspius Fadus, who was procurator of Judea, and joined the Judeans to reposit those vestments in the Tower of Antonia. For that they ought to have them in their power as they formerly had. However, the Judeans sent ambassadors to Claudius Caesar to intercede with him for them, upon whose coming King Agrippa Jr., being then at Rome, asked for and obtained the power over them from the emperor. Of course, Agrippa Jr. was a son of Herod. And he was sent to Rome to be close to the Roman emperor to maintain their close relationship with Herod. Before that time, they were kept under the seal of the high priest and of the treasurers of the temple, which treasurers, the day before a festival, went to the Romans' captain of the temple guards and viewed their own seal and received the vestments. And again, when the festival was over, they brought it to the same place and showed the captain of the temple. So here we see, folks, that even though the Judahites were still trying to practice their traditions, and we're probably talking about Passover here, because that was the only time that the high priest put these vestments on, they had to get permission from the Romans to do so. Okay? All right. And again, when the festival was over, they brought it to the same place and showed the captain of the temple, the guards, their seal, which corresponded with his seal, and reposited him back. And that these things were so, the afflictions that happened to us afterward are sufficient evidence. But for the tower itself, when Herod the king, the tetrarch of Judea, had forfeited it more firmly than before, in order to secure and guard the temple, he gratified Antonius, who was his friend, and the Roman ruler, and then gave it the name of the Tower of Antonia. Okay? So we see this is excellent evidence of the fact that the Judahites were still trying desperately to practice their traditions and Torah, despite that Herod, was doing everything to suppress our religion. Back to you.
Right. This is section 5, or paragraph 5, of chapter 11. Now, in the western quarters of the enclosure of the temple, there were four gates. The first led to the king's palace and went to a passage over the intermediate valley. Two more led to the suburbs of the city, and the last led to the other city, where the road descended down into the valley by a great number of steps, and from there up again by the ascent for the city lay near to the temple in the manner of a theater, and was encompassed with a deep valley along the entire south quarter. But the fourth front of the temple, which was southward, had indeed itself gates in its middle, as also it had the royal cloisters with three walks, which reached in length from the east valley to that on the west, for it was impossible it would reach any farther. And this cloister deserves to be mentioned better than any other under the sun, for while the valley was very deep and its bottom could not be seen, if you look from above into the depth, this further vastly high elevation of the cloister stood upon that height, insomuch that if anyone looked down from the top of the battlements, or down both those altitudes, he would be giddy, while his sight could not reach to such an immense depth.
Wow. So this had to be a deep gorge. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wait, actually, let me just let people know, if you ever come to Chicago, you can experience this giddiness, because the Sears Tower has a couple of glass floors extending out over the building. All right. So you can stand on that glass and look straight down.
I don't think so.
90 floors. I'll bet you get giddy. Back to you.
Well, and also, at that height, those big towers, they flex.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Move back and forth.
On a windy day, you can sway forever.
That's right. Right? Well, the buildings are designed
that
way.
Right. Well, yeah, they have to be. Yeah.
This cloister had pillars that stood in four rows, one near to the other all along, for the fourth row was interwoven into the wall, which also was built of stone, and the thickness of each pillar was such that three men might, with their arms extended, fathom it around and join their hands again. Wow. While its length was 27 feet with a double spiral at its basis. And the number of all the pillars in that court was 162. Their chapiters, that's the top of the pillar, with all the ornamental stuff,
right,
were made with sculptures after the Corinthian order, and caused an amazement to the spectators by reason of the grandeur of the whole.
Almost like Egypt, right?
Right. These four rows of pillars included three intervals for walking in the middle of this cloister, two of which walks were made parallel to each other and were contrived after the same manner. The breadth of each of them was 30 feet. The length was a furlong, and the height 50 feet. But the breadth of the middle part of the cloister was 1.5 of the other, and the height was double, for it was much higher than those on each side. But the roofs were adorned with deep sculptures in wood, representing many sorts of figures.
Gargoyles.
The middle was much higher than the rest, and the wall of the front was adorned with beams resting upon pillars that were interwoven into it, and that front was all of polished stone, insomuch that its fineness to such as had not seen it was incredible, and to such as had seen it was greatly amazing. Thus was the first enclosure, in the midst of which, and not far from it, was the second to be gone up to by a few steps. This was encompassed by a stone wall for a partition, with an inscription which forbade any foreigner to go in under pain of death. Now, this inner enclosure had on its southern and northern quarters three gates equally distant one from another, but on the east quarter, toward the sunrise, there was one large gate through which such as were pure came in together with their wives. But the temple further inward in that gate was not allowed to the women. But still more inward, there was a third court of the temple, whereinto it was not lawful for any but the priest alone to enter. The temple itself was within this, and before that temple was the altar upon which we offer our sacrifices and burnt offerings to God. Into none of these three did King Herod
enter. I was wondering about that.
For he was forbidden because he was not a priest.
And he was not an Israelite either.
However, he took care of the cloisters and the outer enclosures, and these he built in 8 years. Well, we have a Jewish pope.
Right.
So, what's the difference?
Right. Yeah. There's a footnote here.
Section 6 is yours.
There's a footnote here for section 5. Into none of these three did King Herod enter, i.e., not into the court of the priests, nor into the holy house itself, nor into the separate place belonging to the altar, as the words following imply, for none but priests and their attendants, the Levites, might come into any of them. He's quoting from the Old Testament. Okay, and of course Herod was forbidden, and because he was an Edomite, there's no way he would be allowed to go in there. All right, verse 6, section 6. But the temple itself was built by the priests in a year and 6 months, upon which all the people were full of joy. And presently they returned thanks in the first place to God, and in the next place for the alacrity the king had shown. So he was obviously doing this to pacify the true Judahites. They feasted and celebrated this rebuilding of the temple, and for the king he sacrificed 300 oxen to God, as did the rest, everyone according to his ability, the number of which sacrifices it is not possible to set down. For it cannot be that we should truly relate it. For at the same time with this celebration for the work about the temple fell also the day of the king's inauguration, which he kept of old custom as a festival, and it now coincided with the other, which coincidence of them both made the festival most illustrious. So he obviously timed the construction so that those two festivals would come together. One more short paragraph and we're done with book 15. Over to you. Okay, Pastor Steve seems to have taken a break. I'll continue with number 7. There was also an occult passage built for the king.
Oh, I'm sorry, I muted my mic.
Oh, okay.
My right. Fault.
Okay.
In case there was any background noise, I didn't want it to override you. I do that.
Okay, section 7.
My bad, I'm sorry.
Okay.
There was also a secret passage built for the king. It led from Antonia to the inner temple and at its eastern gate, over which he also erected for himself a tower that he might have the opportunity of a subterranean ascent to the temple in order to guard against any rebellion which might be made by the people against their kings. In other words, it was a CYA passage.
Yeah, there you go.
Because he knew that he wasn't really all that popular.
KGB, right?
Yes. Yeah. It is also reported during the time that the temple was building, it did not rain in the daytime, but that the showers fell in the nights, so that the work was not hindered. And this our fathers have told us, nor is it incredible if anyone have regard to the manifestations of God. And thus was performed the work of the rebuilding.
Wow.
The temple.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you're reading, I'm feeling what I'm thinking is that Yahweh allowed this rebuilding and ultimate repair of Solomon's temple in order that the curtain might be rent at the sacrifice of Yahshua. Okay? You get what I'm saying, Pastor Steve? Mm-hmm. Okay. Because that rending of the temple curtain was of great significance. And that would tell us that the sacrifices of the priests were no longer necessary.
He had to shut everything up for future occurrences.
That's right. Every detail, minutest detail.
He doesn't fool around with it.
Right, and he used Herod to do it. Okay.
Well, he used Nebuchadnezzar, and he used a whole bunch of people to do all kinds of different things. He doesn't just use Israelites. He is the divine being, and people tend to forget that, and that if he wants to do something, he will use whatever he wants to use to get it done. Everybody always tries to downsize Yahweh. And it's a pathetic attempt, and it really isn't going to work.
Mm-hmm.
Yahweh's going to do what Yahweh's going to do, and if you don't like it, that's just too bad.
Right, right. But this there's a footnote here to the effect that all of this construction work was so spectacular that just about everybody in the vicinity knew about it. So, in other words, what he's saying, Whiston is saying, this is known history and everybody knows about it. So it's, anybody who thinks that the Bible is fake news, they got another guess coming. This is true history. The Bible is true and every critic a liar.
We've had a bunch of people turn against everything lately.
Yeah, right. And, well, I mean, it's
much to their detriment. Hey, look. Yeah. You know, all we can do is teach and preach the word.
Mm-hmm.
And if people don't want to believe it, that's on them.
That's
right. Hey, I can't force anything on anybody.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, if you wind up in your latter days being an apostate, that's your business. We can't force you to obey Yahweh's laws. What more can we say?
Well, all right, folks. If you profess that you believe, and then you turn back,
backslide. Yep.
You will be twice the child of hell.
Amen.
That's all I can say.
Yeah.
Yahweh bless and keep you, folks. Thanks for listening.
Be good. Be patient. Praise Yahweh. Pass the ammunition. See you all next time.
Too much fun.